Coming up on Golf Today, PGA Tour heads up the coast to a familiar stop, beautiful Pebble Beach, but it'll have a very different look in 2024. Who is there? Who is not? We have the detail. And two LPGA legends were duking it out Sunday in Bradenton as Nelly kept Lydia out of the LPGA Hall of Fame for now. A recap is coming your way. And our Golf Today roundtable hits on the Torrey Pines champ and the future of Tyrrell Hatton. Where is he playing this week? Another busy, juicy Monday on Golf Today.
Golf Today.
Golf Today on a Monday. Damon Hack alongside Eamon Lynch. Look who's back. Golf Week magazine's own writing legend. You were down in Orlando at the PGA show. How was your trip?
It was good. It was good to reconnect with golf as an industry for a change. We spend a lot of time talking about golf as an elite sport. And the sport, I guess, has its meeting place, which is under the tree outside the Augusta National Clubhouse every year at the Masters. The industry of golf, a multi-billion dollar industry, has its meeting place as well, and that is the PGA show.
Industry seems healthy. You mentioned elite golf. We saw some elite golf over the weekend in Orlando and also in Bradenton, Florida. Time now for the Sunday best. What a Sunday it was. LPGA Drive-On Championship. Doesn't get any better than Lydia Ko and Nelly Korda dueling down the stretch. This fairway wood on the 17th hole, par 5, shades of a shot she hit against Minji Lee in San Francisco in 2018.
Coming off a win recently on the LPGA Tour, entered the week as number 9 in the Rolex rankings. Rolled that one in for a top-end eagle, got to 11 under.
3 shots ahead of Nelly, got to finish eagle birdie to force the playoff. This for eagle on 17.
And there were only 2 threes on this hole yesterday, Damon. And these two players were those 2 threes.
A couple of major champs, a couple of Olympic medalists duking it out. Now Nelly on the par 4, 18th, her second. Only 2 birdies on this hole all day to this point.
She needs a third if she wants to force a playoff. She's given herself a chance that even you could wriggle that one in from there, Dan.
Oh, maybe she'll shake that one. And you want to talk about hitting a shot the right weight. That's exactly what she did. Would make the birdie. On to the playoff we go. This is Lydia Ko, par 4, 18th, per second.
It shows you where the mentality of the LPGA Tour was. They thought this was the win that was going to put Lydia into the Hall of Fame. Sitting over there by the stands, champagne and the flowers.
About that, more on that potential champagne jinx in just a little bit. So here's Nelly now, her second. Sit down, ball.
Just into the color.
Right. I mean, and the sun is going down. Nelly, of course, lives in Bradenton. This is Lydia's third.
How tasty is this under pressure, Damon?
Some would say she has the best short game on the LPGA Tour. You might just say among the best short games in the world. Now, this is Nelly's chance for birdie and the win.
Low left.
Yeah. On to the second playoff hole we go. More great golf now. Nelly, she went long on her second. This is her third.
A little bit of work left on that one.
Now, Lydia Ko was on the green in 2, left her birdie putt woefully short. This now for par.
Well, this was not a great finish. Mm. The 20-time winner.
That means this for the win in front of family and friends. Nelly gets it done. In Bradenton, her first win on tour since 2022 and her 9th win on the LPGA. You see the hugs there. And we saw the flowers and the champagne you mentioned. How about 1986 World Series Game 6, Shea Stadium? There was champagne ready to go in the Red Sox clubhouse, you know? Bill Buckner happened. And, of course, Game 7, the Mets go on to win. 1969, Lakers against the Celtics. There's balloons, thousands of balloons in the rafters at the Forum. What happens? Bill Russell and the Celtics win. Those thousands of balloons stayed in the rafters. Happy days are here again. Was supposed to play on the speakers. Never happened. And there you see the flowers and the champagne waiting, we thought, for Lydia Ko's entree in the LPGA Hall of Fame.
As Ian Poulter says, you don't want to be a little bit previous on this kind of stuff. And you can understand why the LPGA Tour wanted the celebrations to happen there on that green, but again, Nelly Korda had something to say about that, so perhaps they were best kept in a little bit more discreet fashion. It's just a shame Lydia Ko hit her ball right up against it. But that was a perfect example of what the LPGA Tour needed.
Yeah.
And you have arguably the two biggest stars in the game going just toe-to-toe in a really high-quality, high-drama, head-to-head playoff. Mm. And Nelly having to go 3-under on the last two holes to make that playoff. It doesn't get any better than that. The flip side of that is now the LPGA Tour is basically taking 3 weeks off and then goes on a 3-week swing through Asia, which in the last few years, a lot of the top players, certainly a lot of the top American players, have tended to skip that swing. Lexi Thompson, for example, has not played out there. So it's actually the last week of March before the LPGA Tour gets back in the United States to play. And that speaks to the problems that players have building momentum, but
yeah.
It also speaks to the product building momentum as well. It just feels as though it's a schedule change that we discussed it last year. It's probably not an easy fix,
yeah.
But it is something that they ought to address at some stage.
Well, yesterday was must-see viewing, the LPGA Drive On Championship. A little bit later in the show, we'll be joined by Golf Week senior writer Beth Ann Nichols and Golf Channel's own Amy Rogers for an LPGA roundtable. Go a little bit deeper on Sunday's incredible final round. Right now, we shift our focus to the men's game. PGA Tour heads up the California coast from San Diego to the Monterey Peninsula for the AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am. You can take the 5 or 101 freeway or the slower, more scenic route, which is the Pacific Coast Highway Route 1. As this week always produces some of the best views, breathtaking, gorgeous shots high above Stillwater Cove. And it's a new look for the AT&T this year, a signature event, limited field of 80 players competing in a no-cut tournament over two courses, not three, for a $20 million purse. And Pebble Beach and Spyglass are in the rotation. Monterey Peninsula no longer in the rotation. You see some of the more changes as well. Amateurs will only play on Thursday and Friday. Todd Lewis on site all week. He joins us now from Pebble Beach. Tilo, I must say it's a very different look for 2024.
Yeah, we had a full field event for a number of years here and amateurs playing all 4 days, but that's not going to be the case with the amateurs only playing Thursday and Friday. And on two golf courses, you mentioned Spyglass and Pebble Beach. Spyglass, by the way, the more challenging of the two golf courses. But because the way this tournament was set in the schedule in recent years, the field, well, let's just say it hasn't been as strong as you may think, given that it is taking place at Pebble Beach, but that's not the case here this week. All 80 players who qualified have committed to play in this tournament, and some of them are making a return trip from a long time ago, like Keegan Bradley. He hasn't been here since 2011. Justin Thomas's 10-year anniversary since he last played here. Xander Schauffele, a California guy. He hasn't played here in a while. Some are playing this event for the very first time. And you see Hideki Kawa Morikawa, another California guy who's playing here for the first time. And world number one, Scottie Scheffler. But considering the significance of this tournament, and let's not forget it is Pebble Beach, all in the field are excited to tee it up here this week.
Yeah, I think it's great. Pebble, especially, and obviously Spyglass, they're two of the most iconic golf courses in the world, especially Pebble Beach. And yeah, it's a shame we're going to get bad weather, but I think it's great that, you know, a bunch of us are going to be going there and getting to showcase the golf courses. Yeah, and I'm excited. It's one of those events that was always in a funky part of the schedule, and it's one of my favorite places on the planet, but it's hard to, you know, it was just hard to play it a bunch. But going to two courses, a little less chaotic and less players, I think is going to be a big hit.
I haven't played the AT&T for a while, so I'm going in it, you know, kind of just looking forward to the new challenge of the week. You know, it's I got a good opportunity to play with a good friend of mine, Ryan Smith, which is going to be fun. And Pebble is an incredible place. I haven't been there since the Open in 19, so I just looking forward to returning there.
It's been a few years since I've been up at Pebble. Yeah, I mean, just one less course to prep for. It should make the week a little bit easier versus a three. And, yeah, I mean, I think it – I mean, I'm hoping the rain kind of subsides a little bit. It didn't look great last night when I looked or checked it out on the weather app. And just got to, you know, keep plotting along here.
And you heard Tony Finau playing with Ryan Smith, who was the owner of the Utah Jazz. And you heard Xander and Max talking about the weather. And it is not ideal conditions, at least Thursday, Friday, and Saturdays. temps in the 50s and you see the rain in the forecast. So it's going to be not the best weather. I've been coming here for a long time. You see Thursday, there's a chance of thunderstorms. I've never seen thunderstorms here. But, you know, weather is a part of playing at Pebble Beach and Spy in this tournament. So it will definitely be a factor.
That's peak summer weather where I come from, Todd. Let's dig in on this field a little bit. I know a lot of the signature events are going to have variable field numbers, but this isn't one of them. It's going to have 80 pros, 80 amateurs. But right. Based on all the chatter out there, it seems to be a very convoluted process of how this field is actually coming together in terms of who has priority to get in there.
Well, it is interesting in the fact that the PGA Tour has added some components and some avenues for players to get in these signature events based on their performance in the FedEx Cup standings. There is the Aon top five, the top five points getters from the previous full field events. And then there's the Aon next 10. Now, that is based on the FedEx Cup fall standings, positions 51 through 60. That was established back in the fall. But because this is such a unique event that has to have 80 players in the field because it is a pro-am, players ranked 61 and beyond, basically right now 61 through 69, are going to get a chance to play in this signature event. And a great opportunity, last man in is Keith Mitchell, who is 69th in the FedEx Cup fall standings. And if players drop out, which could happen here this week, then they will move to number 70 in the FedEx Cup fall standings. So some players are getting an opportunity that they normally would not get in signature events, and we'll see if they can make the most of it.
Very interesting, Todd. Another interesting aspect of this event, an argument could be made that the biggest stars for a time were Bill Murray and Jack Lemmon. Ams have been such a huge part of this event. What is happening to the amateurs now?
Well, there is a reduced field now with 80 players, so obviously there are not as many amateurs that we have seen in the past. But there are some recognizable names that you will see in regards to amateurs. But now the amateur competition, the Pro-Am competition, will take place on Thursday and Friday. They will play Pebble Beach and Spyglass. And after those two rounds, then the Pro-Am team will be, well, there'll be a winning Pro-Am team, and they will get the Crystal Trophy like they have in years past. They will get their names on the Wall of Fame, a beautiful plaque. So they will go through a ceremony that we have seen in years past, but it just won't happen on Sunday now. It'll happen on Friday.
A lot of change, Todd, but one thing that hasn't changed is the title sponsor. AT&T has been sponsoring this event since 1986. There's a lot of noise out there about various sponsors who aren't renewing on the tour, some who are more committed than others. Where does AT&T fall on this spectrum these days?
Well, that's a very interesting point, Eamon, and we have seen some title sponsors in Wells Fargo. We saw Honda leave last year as well. And right now, this is the last year in the contract that AT&T has to be the title sponsor with the PGA Tour. Now, talking to Steve John, who is the chairman of the Monterey Peninsula Foundation, basically the tournament director. I spoke with him this morning, and there are talks between the PGA Tour and AT&T and continuing this partnership over the next few years, and of course having this as a signature event at Pebble Beach. But right now, as of now, we don't know what's going to happen in 2025 in regards to a title sponsorship, but talks are going on.
Lots of changes we do know in 2024, including 9 of the top 10 in the world in this field. Thiele, we'll visit you next hour. Thanks so much. All right, folks, check this out. World number 16, Tyrrell Hatton, still listed in the field at Pebble Beach. But according to a report in the Telegraph, Hatton will become the latest player to leave the PGA Tour and join Jon Rahm's LIV golf team in time for Friday's first round of LIV's season opener at Mayakoba, a former PGA Tour stop. You get all of that? Now, what's going on here? You've got the PGA Tour and PIF negotiating. Is this a player in Hatton getting a quick slice of the LIV cake before the pie comes together?
Well, Jon Rahm was the leverage point in negotiations when the Saudis hired him. They got to find him a team by Friday, and Tyrrell Hatton's that guy. And it might actually make people want to watch LIV just to see if all the theatrics and loud music make Tyrrell Hatton's head explode out there. But it's ultimately kind of meaningless here. And it's a reminder of how many golfers there are towards the upper echelon of the game who are actually kind of meaningless. Mm. He doesn't elevate LIV in any real extent, and he doesn't diminish the PGA Tour in any real extent, minorly, as entertainment value. The only loss to the PGA Tour is the revenue that they get from fining him every week for audible obscenities out there. But ultimately, you know, this is a guy who's won once on the PGA Tour. That was 4 years ago. He hasn't top 10 in a major in 5 years. He's won $21 million.
He's a European Ryder Cupper, though. I mean, he's not an unknown. And does it further confuse the golf fans saying, hey, what's going on? I thought these were entities coming together. Is it just is it a nothing headline?
I don't think it's a nothing headline. This is the reality of what the framework agreement put in place when the tour said, these people are good enough to be in business with. We're going to try to be in business with them. Why wouldn't any player do that? So you're going to see probably more of this happen as well. There are rumors about Adrian Morant, the player of the year in Europe last year as well, also being in that lineup by the time we get to Friday in Mexico. But this is ultimately the fallout from what the framework agreement put in place. And if there is going to be a significant period of review by the Department of Justice for any Saudi involvement in the game of golf on this side of the Atlantic, well, then there's a good chance that LIV is going to operate through 2024, 2025, and perhaps beyond until that's actually finalized. So, of course, they're going to want their lineup out there. I don't think he's going to be the last one you'll see go. It was more impactful when a John Rahm leaves than when a Tyrrell Hatton leaves.
Well, news coming hourly in this story. We'll dig into this more a little bit later in our Golf Today Roundtable.
We will. And coming up, we have a former winner of the AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am joining us, and he's got a lot to say about the changes. Peter Jacobson, coming up right after the break. Time now for our Past Champ Chat, and Peter Jacobson joins us now. Peter, I know you've got such tremendous affection for this tournament over the years. You had the long-running narrative storyline, could you get Jack Lemmon into the weekend? Could he make the cut for so many years? All of that seems to be in danger of being consigned to history now. Are you a fan of the changes that we're going to see coming into place this week?
Well, I've got mixed emotions. Number one, you showed the video there for me to think about all the fun that I personally had with Jack Lemmon and Clint Eastwood and Fluff and all the amateurs and celebrities that I've played with at the AT&T. I relish those memories. But I am excited about where the tournament is going. I hope that it maintains the camaraderie and the energy and the fun that we've had since the Crosby Clam Bake started. When I saw the list of the players that are making their return visit back to Pebble Beach after so many years, they talk about it being iconic golf courses. I think a lot of players forget the fact that the AT&T is the most important tournament and continues to be on the PGA Tour. All these tournaments on tour are focused on results, who wins. The AT&T is the most important event because it focuses on the business of the PGA Tour, the camaraderie. Where else can you spend 5 or 6 hours inside the ropes and playing golf with a title sponsor or an executive vice president of a company that sponsors a tournament on your tour? So the fact that we could build those relationships during the AT&T, I hope we're not going to lose that. I hope the players that are playing this week, the 80 players, understand that and continue to foster that feeling about why these people sponsor and support the PGA Tour.
Jake, this is a golf tournament that is imprinted on your soul, and I've been trying to figure out why. And I read an old story from Thomas Bonk in 1995, LA Times, when you won, and he quotes Davis Love III that said you were lost for a few years, that you had lost your father as Davis Love had, and you were kind of wandering in the wilderness for a few years when you got that fifth win. It was your first win in 5 years on tour. What did that moment mean to you, kind of lost and then found again at Pebble Beach?
David, I think that's what happens when you have a long career, and I've been fortunate to have a long career. I think you can play at the highest level, and then something happens in your life, like we all struggle through with loss in our life. And my father taught me how to play. And when I lost him, I really lost the desire to play because I didn't feel like I had any meaning in the game, because without him to watch me hit some balls and work on my game, I figured it was over. So I went in, I did some TV, but then watching television and calling the action at that time in 94, or 93, I think it was, I realized how much I loved the game. And I came back, and as you showed, I won at Pebble in 95. And it rekindled my spirit for golf. But I think everybody that has a long career has the ups and the downs. And you really find your passion. And that's really the wonderful thing about the game of golf. The accomplishment aspect of this is you're really forced to find what motivates you and what moves you. And for me, it was playing the game of golf, playing with people and friends that I know and still love to do. I don't, like I said, I don't play as well as I used to, but getting out there and hitting that first tee shot in any round of golf is very special.
On that subject of what motivates you or what moves you, when you look at the guys out there now, Peter, you know, you mentioned that this was the important week because it built those relationships, the business relationships that sustain the tour. Do you believe the guys out there now share that sentiment?
I don't think they do. I think one of the things we've missed over the past 20, 25 years is teaching or shining a light on the business of the PGA Tour. Let's face it, Eamon, players come and players go. I saw your report on Tyrrell Hatton leaving to go to live. Who cares? It doesn't matter. He does not impact the PGA Tour. There's really only been two needle movers in the game, you think about it, Arnold Palmer and Tiger Woods. People stop and watch. All of us other players, and it could be Jack, it could be Faldo, it could be Norman, it could be all these players, we all benefit from those needle movers. And that's the one thing. If I could be commissioner for a day, I would make sure that we taught the players the business of the PGA Tour. I just wish the players today would be a little bit more committed to their organization. I understand we're all trying to make money and we're doing for ourselves, but like I said, players come and players go. But the organization, the communities where we play, and the charities we support, that is the strength of the PGA Tour.
Jake, there are so many unknowns as we sit here on this Monday about the future of professional golf. Are you bullish or are you concerned?
I'm a little bit both. I'm excited about the quality of the players we've got. Some of these young men are incredible ambassadors of the game and leaders in the game. But I worry a little bit about too much of the focus being on me. We have to remember why we're there. We're there because of, like I said, the communities where we play and the charities we support. So as we step into this new generation with the LIV and the PIF and the PGA Tour, I think Monahan's doing a great job. He's really in a difficult position, almost a no win position, whatever decision is made. But I support him. I support the PGA Tour, and I support the players as well. We're all in the same arena. We're all trying to accomplish the same goal, but we have to all step back and take a look at where we came from to be able to determine where we're going in the future.
That's a common sentiment we hear from a lot of veterans, Peter, this idea that the tour was built by others, will be inherited by others. But what would you say to players who say, you know what, you're a dinosaur, that this is our asset, we are best positioned now to decide what is the best for this game?
Well, I would say I am a dinosaur, but don't forget when Curtis Strange, we were talking about Curtis won back-to-back U.S. Opens, and he was the thing. He was it on tour. He doesn't play anymore. When I came out on tour, Arnold was the guy. Jack was the person. Gary Player was the man. Players like that, Lee Trevino, but they don't play anymore. So we pass the baton from generation to generation, and you can't be so individually and focused. You can't be selfish enough to think it's only about you. It's about the organization, and it's about helping others. When Arnold had a chance, when Greg Norman presented the LIV Tour in 94, and I was in that room with Arnold, I was playing with him in the Shark Shootout as his partner, Arnold dismissed it completely out of hand. He said, I had a chance to do this with Jack and Gary when we were the big three. He said, this would hurt golf, confuse the sponsors, confuse the fans, and hurt the other players on the tour. So it was completely taken out of the conversation. I admire that because he really took a stand for the greater good. And I hope going forward, we don't lose that.
Do you have faith in the board and more specifically the player directors, who are probably the loudest voice on the PGA board? Do you have faith in them to get it right?
I do. I have great faith in the policy board, and I have great faith in the player directors. What concerns me is the body. Any of the players that have not sat on the PGA Tour or been in a player on the player advisory council, making comments offhand without knowing what they're talking about. It's difficult when you're sitting in that boardroom and there's decisions being made, big money decisions, future direction decisions. That's difficult. And I know the board and the players, the player directors on the board, are doing their very best for the good of the PGA Tour and for the best for the game.
Jake, you bring a lot of wisdom to Pebble Beach Talk and the game as a whole. Thanks for a few minutes. We'll speak to you soon.
You got it. Good to see y'all.
There he is, Jake. All right, folks, we witnessed quite the Saturday finish on the PGA Tour. Matthew Pavon became the first player representing France to win on tour since World War II. His journey to the tour was an interesting one. We explain when Golf Today returns. More on the weekend than season so far. Time for a Golf Today roundtable. Welcome in Ryan Lavner and Golf Digest senior editor Todd Leonard. Great to see you both, Todd. We had you on last week. There were questions about the Farmers Field. Would the fans show up? Questions about sponsorship. How was the week that was?
So it was about as great as they could expect it, to be honest. I mean, other than having a high name winner like a Xander or a Max Homa, it was absolutely what they expected or want. The weather was fantastic. You guys saw it on the weekend. It was very San Diego-like for January. And the crowds were huge the last couple of days, especially on Saturday, that early Saturday finish. It was packed around the 18th green, absolutely packed. And so I think one of the things that I take away from this is that, especially in San Diego, where we love the outdoors, we love big events, I don't think it really matters who's on the leaderboard when the weather's good and it's Torrey Pines. People love to go out to Torrey Pines. They sold out all of their hospitality. I just don't think that they're seeing any kind of negative impact whatsoever from all this talk about whether Farmers is going to be there, who's in the field, things like that. It's such an established tournament on the PGA Tour that I don't think it really matters at this point necessarily who's in the field.
Ryan, it certainly mattered in advance whenever a lot of the Korn Ferry Tour guys were griping that guys coming off the European Tour should not have priority over them. When you've got Pavon winning, Nicolai finishing second, does that undermine that argument any?
Well, I still think if you're a Korn Ferry Tour grad, I think it is actually a fair gripe. I mean, the PGA Tour is essentially telling its own feeder system that they are not as important as the strategic alliance with the DP World Tour. You know, from a business perspective, it was a no-brainer to try and poach some of the best European players. We've already seen some early returns on the PGA Tour. Pavon's a winner. Nicolai Højgaard finishes second. Thorbjørn Olesen, who actually did earn one of those 10 cards, just won again on the DP World Tour. And so although it is a fair gripe, I think it remains to be seen whether it's actually a legitimate gripe. And that answer won't be known until September. When you look at the stats, roughly half of the Korn Ferry Tour grads from last season ended up keeping their cards. If you're the PGA Tour and you can get half of these 10 European Tour players to keep their PGA Tour cards for the following season, I think that would be viewed as a success.
Todd, you'd mentioned that, you know, there are some things about this tournament that can't be undermined by players not being there or sponsor changes, things like that. We're going to see a lot more changes up the coast this week at Pebble Beach. A lot of less celebrities, probably more CEOs, a lot less players, but a lot higher quality of players. What are you anticipating? Do you think it's something that a little bit of the tour history and California golf history is gone? Or is this a positive move, you think, for the fan experience?
I think it's a positive experience for the tournament itself because it's had such a mixed field in the past because there are guys who don't want to play long rounds with celebrities or CEOs. So I think it's a positive from Pebble Beach's standpoint. And I also think it's a positive for the West Coast swing because an event on the coast beyond LA needed to be another signature event, whether it was Torrey Pines or whether it was Pebble Beach. This is such a golf-rich area and tour-rich area that I just see it as, I'm sure the fans of Pebble are thrilled. And also that, you know, losing one course there and just having Spyglass and Pebble, I think is a big step forward, because those are the courses that people identify with and they understand, where Monterey Peninsula Country Club wasn't really a course that was on anybody's radar other than the tournament. So, again, I see that as a positive, and it doesn't, I don't think, you know, damage anything out here as far as the prestige of these events.
Laf, what do you think? Signature events. I mean, this is the perfect week to see it kind of in action, you know, next to what has been an old school traditional event on the PGA Tour. But so far, are signature events working in your estimation?
Well, it's a very small sample size, and so let's just take a step back. I think when you look, Damon, at the entirety of the first month of the PGA Tour season, we've had terrific stories. I don't think any better than the amateur Nick Dunlap winning at PGA West. But this is supposed to be a star-studded showcase this week at Pebble Beach with the 80-man field. It's a tournament that, when it was announced, it was going to be getting signature event status. A lot of people were excited, myself included. And when you look at this ongoing civil war between the PGA Tour and LIV Golf, one of the PGA Tour's key advantages, to me at least, are these historic venues, these recognizable venues that every golf fan in the world knows. And to see the best players at the best courses that the PGA Tour has to offer, I mean, this is essentially a miniature U.S. Open in February. I can't wait to see how the week goes. But if you're the PGA Tour and you've seen kind of how the first month has gone with these long shots or these underdogs, although they're great stories, this is a week where you kind of need the juggernauts and the powerhouses to go head-to-head.
Ryan, we deal with a lot of wild rumors these days. Every time we see each other in this show, there's another one that's come up. And the latest one, of course, is Anthony Kim and the potential second coming. Was he all that? I mean, this mythology has built up around Anthony Kim, but the reality seemed to me that he was doing a pretty good job of wasting his career when he stepped away 12 years ago. Is there any reasonable expectation that he could have a significant, noticeable impact should he come back?
I mean, it would certainly be unprecedented. A player who leaves at the peak of his powers and returns to his professional sport 12 years later. I'm not a historian, but I can't think of an example, at least in current times. You know, the golf writer in me would love to cover the story. I think it's great. It has so many juicy components to it. But as a golf fan, as a golf observer, I can't help to be skeptical. And the main reason of skepticism is why now? I think the easy answer is to look at it and say this is the richest period in PGA Tour history. You could have, you know, the guaranteed money of LIV Golf, which could cover any of the insurance policy that he would have to forfeit back. And so, you know, to your point, I understand the nostalgia. I'm certainly of a similar vintage to AK, who is now a 38. But there has to be so much atrophy from not playing tournament competition for a dozen years. He's actually past his prime now for what a PGA Tour player is, between 28 and 32. And I think it's easily forgotten that AK's game was already sort of deteriorating by the time that he walked away in 2012. The injuries were stacking up with his hand, with his Achilles. He was battling the driver yips. And so I'm not sure golf fans actually want him to come back. It may be a situation where he's best left as this folk hero and this cult figure in golf as opposed to a comeback that actually falls flat.
Todd, we covered AK together, Height of Power. I remember being in San Diego at Torrey Pines when Mark Romero said he was the best young player that he'd seen since Tiger Woods. Why is there this hankering on X and on social media about this 38-year-old player?
Well, that's what makes me laugh, because I just don't feel the hankering. You know, I mean, to me, this is a publicity grab, a money grab. And I think there's this really narrow sample of people our age, or, you know, in that period where we were even remember him. I mean, the younger generation has no idea who he is. The very older generation is like, who cares? So it's such a narrow kind of golf geek demographic for who's going to care if he comes back, and they're going to care for what, one round? So I just, to me, this is all pretty laughable given how long he's been gone and what his level of play could be at this point.
Speaking of this will anyone care sentiment, Ryan, the revolving door could potentially turn again in the coming days if the reports are true from the Telegraph that Tyrrell Hatton is going to live. Does it matter?
I'm disappointed.
So a couple of things here, and I heard what you said, Eamon, a couple of minutes ago. First thing is that it's another personality gone on the PGA Tour with Tyrrell Hatton. Whether you love him, whether you loathe him, you can now put him with the live rebels like Phil, like Patrick Reed, Sergio Garcia, Bryson DeChambeau. You at least have some sort of opinion on Tyrrell Hatton. Secondly, there's always this temptation to say, you know, 1 to 10, how much does this hurt the PGA Tour? Does he move the needle on live? When you couple Tyrrell Hatton with Adrian Meronk, who's also rumored to be signing with live golf, I mean, these are very solid, competitive top 40 players who you could argue have not yet played their best golf on the world stage. I think if nothing else, it just underscores the point that we're getting further and further away from having the best players all in one spot. It's slightly reducing the PGA Tour while benefiting LIV just as marginally. That's not doing golf fans any good at this juncture.
Solid players and a little more confusion at home for the golf fan. We appreciate Lav and Todd joining us. By the way, if you're in the market for more conversations like this one, be sure to check out the Golf Today podcast. Great interviews and guests as well. Yes, subscribe to At Golf Channel on YouTube. More great discussions as well. Back in a bit.
It was a strong Sunday for the LPGA Tour as two of its biggest stars went to a thrilling sudden-death playoff. But now the tour is leaving America for almost 2 months. We'll dig in on the highs and the hiccups in the women's game right now. And the PGA Tour announced the newest members of the Players Advisory Council, and it includes a few guys who haven't been shy about sharing their anger about the direction the tour is taking. Todd Lewis will have the latest entry from the Palace in Pontevedra. And we'll remember Jackie Burke Jr. on what would have been his 101st birthday. Golf Today continues now.
Golf Today.
Welcome back into Golf Today. Eamon Lynch alongside Damon Hack. And Damon, if you were Molly Marcoux, a man, you had to be the happiest person in sport yesterday. Forget about the 49ers fans or anybody else. I mean, you couldn't have drawn up in central casting a better result than she had yesterday in terms of the finish and who was involved.
Hankering seems to be the word of the day. We talked about a hankering for rivalries, a hankering for things in this game. I've been hankering for Nelly Korda, Jin Young Ko. We got Nelly Korda and Lydia Ko yesterday, and it was incredible. Listen, stars are a huge part of sports. It was a remarkable final round. Did you catch it? The drive-on championship last night with 20 holes, but now a 9-time winner in Nelly Korda, her first win of the season in her hometown of Bradenton, second playoff hole. Incredible golf from both, really, down the stretch. And here now, the winner, a 9-time winner on the LPGA Tour at home, Nelly Korda.
I'm not going to lie and say that, you know, there weren't doubts and negative thoughts creep into my head. And fortunately, I have an amazing teammate, caddy, right next to me that I get to share this journey with and the gray hairs with.
I know all of your wins are special. What does this one mean to get it done in front of these fans, in front of this really super supportive crowd? I know you spoke to it on the green.
Yeah, I mean, every win has a story. This one was definitely just with the struggles of last year and just with today as well. I thought I completely lost it, and having the hometown, being in my hometown and having the hometown support was incredible. Like, I honestly didn't think this many people would show up. And even on just the first day on Thursday, the amount of people that were out here supporting was incredible. And I couldn't have done it without all their, like, positive energy.
So Lydia opens the season with a win and a second place. She's 1 point shy of earning her place in the LPGA Hall of Fame. She hung around afterwards. She signed autographs. She greeted the Korda family and friend group as well. And Lydia was gracious in defeat.
What happened on that little putt there in the playoff?
Yeah, you know, I actually hit a good stroke on it. It just broke a little bit more than I thought. You know, the first putt, it's difficult, I think, when there's a lot of grain. And I was just, I honestly didn't think I hit it that far short. But obviously, I misjudged the slope and the grain of it. But I played really solid today. You know, I had a few three putts today, and I think that was, you know, at the end, like, that was what I think cost the tournament. But, you know, to be at an eagle that 17, and, you know, even have a chance of winning when I actually thought I was, like, quite a ways behind. No, it was nice to be, like, in contention again, like, 2 weeks in a row.
It was a wild day, really, wasn't it, today? I mean, you were just seeing it from your group's perspective, but it was kind of back and forth. But that shot you mentioned there on 17 was exquisite. Can you talk about it?
To be honest, I thinned it a little bit. So I actually thought it was going in the water, but, you know, I made just enough contact that it carried the water, and, you know, it just ended up being a very stress-free eagle. And I had a really good two-putt here on the 72nd hole as well. So I played really well. You know, if I go down the hole of saying, you know, those shots that maybe, like, oh, if I did that a little better, then it's just endless. So, you know, good to be able to finish, you know, win last week and then finish second this week.
Wouldn't we all like to thin our way to a stress-free eagle? For a little more on this, we're going to be joined by my Golf Week colleague Beth Ann Nichols alongside Golf Channel reporter Amy Rogers. And Amy, I'd like to start with you. I'm curious what you think this does for Nelly Korda's confidence, because it's not your run-of-the-mill win. She's coming off a poor season. She's going up against somebody who won last week, an all-time great, and she does it with an eagle birdie to make the playoff and then triumphs in the playoff. This has got to be an enormous boost for Nelly Korda.
Well, if we didn't know already, we certainly learned it on Sunday. Do not count out Nelly Korda. This is not the first time that she's created some drama for herself down the closing stretch. Remember back in 2021 at the Annika event, she came into that final stretch with the lead as well. Made triple bogey on the 71st hole, but rallied with a birdie on the 72nd to force a four-person playoff that she went on to win. Well, we saw that same sort of resilience from Korda here yesterday as well, as she rallied from that bogey, double bogey, bogey stretch with an eagle birdie to force that playoff from Lydia Ko. And as Nelly said afterwards in her post-round press conference, you know, I think she learned a lot of valuable lessons, and to learn them so early in the season will be a springboard for her, hopefully going forward, to make these next few victories a lot more drama-free, at least on her end. But for the rest of us, it was great. It was must-see TV.
Beth Ann, I'm thinking of Hank Aaron's home run chase, trying to chase down Babe Ruth, or Tiger Woods' no-cut streak, or his four straight major championships. Is there a world where Lydia Ko's pursuit of the LPGA Hall of Fame becomes a storyline that we follow throughout the next couple of weeks or months, and that it's good for the LPGA?
I definitely think so. As much as I wanted to see Lydia, you know, win yesterday, there was a big part of me. It was like, wait, I'm not ready for this. I'm not ready to say goodbye, because I think, you know, we don't know exactly what Lydia's going to do. Lydia probably doesn't know what she's going to do. But I think most of us would be hard-pressed to think she'll be playing much longer after she gets into the LPGA Hall of Fame. So for the LPGA, this is a great thing to be able to stretch it out, you know, get some media attention. Hopefully some folks who normally don't spend the resources to get out and cover the LPGA, that they will, when they know that there's this exciting storyline to follow with Lydia Ko, because she's just so gosh darn likable.
Amy, is that an opportunity for the LPGA Tour that Beth Ann has just touched on, when there's so much uncertainty and lack of clarity around the men's game and sponsors wondering if they really want to sustain the kind of purse increases that are out there now? Is that an opportunity for the LPGA Tour to say, look, this is what we've got and it's pretty darn good?
Absolutely. It's funny you should mention that, because Beth Ann and I were sitting in the media center at the season opener having this exact discussion. We had just heard about the Wells Fargo sponsorship obviously going by the wayside after this 2024 season. And now we're seeing the Farmers Insurance Open, that title sponsorship also going away in 2026 as well. And I think there's a possibility here for some of these companies, if they want to stay in the golf space, to make a transition potentially to the LPGA. I mean, we've seen the title sponsorships on the PGA Tour side increase $13 to $15 million. I mean, that's more than all of the total purses on the LPGA Tour. So I think there's an opportunity here for these companies to remain invested, to stay in the golf space, and maybe a little bit of a smaller investment.
Beth Ann, what do you think? The star power that we saw really the last couple of weeks on the LPGA, is it a different vibe, a different feel, a selling point for this tour?
Well, it was certainly much needed because, as we all know, you know, neither Lydia nor Nelly Korda won last year on the LPGA. And you throw in that mix of Alexi Thompson, and it's the tour's desperate for it. And I really think the LPGA was smart because last week during the drive on early in the week, they had a media training for their players. And, you know, these players need to know that they can't tell their story enough. That's the message that they heard. That anytime they have an opportunity to tout the LPGA, to talk about their road to where they are, that they should do it because not enough people know the world number one Lilia Vu story. And it's a remarkable one. And I just think that, you know, the LPGA needs its stars to say yes to these more than they say no.
Beth Ann, you know that we never really just get to talk inside the rope stuff anymore. There's been a long rumbling attempt at a merger between the LPGA Tour and the Ladies European Tour. It was supposed to be voted on. The vote hasn't happened, and neither are reports that Gulf Saudi has stymied it since the Saudi Arabian oil company Aramco finances 25% of the purses on the LET. What can you tell us about the latest state of those discussions?
Yeah, so the LPGA commissioner sent a letter to the players earlier this month that shed a little bit of light on why there was such an abrupt reversal. I mean, these players walked into the season-ending event in Spain and expected to vote, and then were told at the very last minute, never mind. And essentially, at the very last minute, Gulf Saudi requested more information was the official line, that they wanted to know more about the ins and outs of how this would impact them, this potential merger. But we all know this wasn't a last-minute thing. As you said, this was postponed at the end of 2022. I mean, these two tours have been working on this merger and the details of it for a really long time. And essentially, Gulf Saudi said, look, you know, before we finalize our events for the 2024 schedule, we need to take a pause on this vote. And so the pause is an indefinite one. The players have no idea. I don't even think the tour has any idea when they might vote again. It might come at the end of this year. But the reality is, you know, this is the first major power move that we've seen Gulf Saudi make in the women's space in terms of calling something off in a big way and essentially, you know, threatening to not hold their events. And so, you know, the letter went on to say, you can see that our relationship, you know, is still in a good place as evidenced by the schedule. All those events are on the 2024 schedule for the LET. So a lot of question marks.
Beth Ann, tennis is having a similar discussion. You have Chris Everett and Martina Navratilova saying don't engage with the Saudis because of women's rights issues, whereas Billie Jean King is saying you have to engage to open minds and to have change happen. Do you think that the conversations are similar inside the locker room of the LPGA, more amenable to those discussions, or are there more concerns about women's rights?
You know, I don't hear as many conversations about women's rights as you would think. It's more about money and opportunity and what does this mean for long-term sponsors for the tour. It's less of an ethical conversation, I think, for many players and more of a practical one. And I think, you know, there's some concern that if we do put all of our eggs in the Saudi basket, what does that mean going forward? You know, if the Saudis come in and have a lot of control on the LPGA, you know, what are other title sponsors going to think about that? How many might drop out, you know, from an appearance sake, even though they might actually do business in Saudi Arabia? But what does it look like to have that partnership with a women's organization? You know, so, you know, it's really murky. And at the end of the day, it's no different than the men's game in many ways, and that it all comes down to money. What is different, though, is that I don't know that these tours could survive should they go full in with the Saudis, and then the Saudis change their mind in 5 years, 3 years. What's left?
And even if they don't change their mind, I guess there's still a reputational question as well. Amy, on this idea of the schedule, we've just had a couple of hot weeks on the LPGA Tour schedule here with Lydia winning, obviously Nelly in that playoff yesterday. Now they're taking a few weeks off, then it's a 3-week swing in Asia that some of the top American players tend to stay away from for the travel reasons. So it's 2 months almost, last week of March, before we get back in the United States. We had this conversation last year. Is it an issue, and is it fixable? Because I know they do have a huge market in Asia as well, but does it halt the product momentum in any way in your mind?
I think the LPGA knows that it's an issue. We've heard Molly Marcuse-Simon say in early days that trying to create a schedule that was more conducive for their athletes was something that was a priority. And I think they've tried to do that again this season with adding that second stop in Florida after the season opener. But to your point, they knew sooner get going with these two amazing weeks. They really couldn't have gotten off to a better start. And now we're seeing a halt in momentum, as now we're going to wait another 4 weeks before the LPGA gets going again. And once it does, unfortunately, they're going to be playing in the middle of the night with the time difference. And so a lot of times the action sort of gets lost in the shuffle for fans as well. That's also coming off the heels of a very short offseason. They've added that Grant Thornton Invitational in late December. And I spoke to Lilia Vu and a number of other players who were remarking at just how short that time off was. I mean, Lilia Vu saying, you know, she just feels like she didn't have a lot of time to regroup. Coming into the season opener, she said she felt very stressed. And I think that we've seen that now in her results. I mean, through the first two events of the year, the top-ranked player has been really a non-factor, hasn't been able to break 70 through the first two events of the year. So I think having that extra time, finding that right sort of balance and cadence with having time off and then getting the schedule going on a more regular basis rather than this stop and start would be something that everyone would be welcome to figuring out.
Well, it has been an incredible start to the LPGA season. That much we know. Amy Rogers, Beth Ann Nichols, thank you very much.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
The PGA Tour has just announced the newest members of the 16-man Players Advisory Council, a committee that is intended to represent the views of members to the board. And that list includes a couple of recent winners and some guys who've been pretty vocal about what they don't like. Could there be some fireworks in the offing? Todd Lewis is coming up with the details.
Golf Central Update, brought to you by Callaway Golf.
We're back on Golf Today. On Sunday, the PGA Tour announced the 16-member Player Advisory Council for the year. The PAC advises and consults with the PGA Tour Policy Board, Board of Directors, and Commissioner Jay Monahan on issues affecting the tour. Here are the names here. You got some major champs and Ryder Cuppers, some veterans and some young players at the beginning of their career. Quite an interesting brew, I would say. Todd Lewis joins us once again from Pebble Beach, side of this week's signature event. T. Lou, any interesting names that stand out to you on this list?
Yeah, there's several interesting names. You kind of have to understand what the PAC's duty is. It's supposed to represent the tour. There are conversations, proposals that happen in this PAC, in these PAC meetings throughout the year, and then ultimately a proposal is presented to the PGA Tour Policy Board that's made up of player directors, players on tour, and other folks of business that make up the tour, and then ultimately a vote is cast as to whether or not any proposal will happen. Well, the 16 players, I mean, you have some stars, you know, Sam Burns, Brian Harman, Max Homa, Scottie Scheffler, Justin Thomas, but you also have players that represent what, you know, maybe the journeyman kind of golfer. And you look there and you see Lonto Griffin, Grayson Murray. I can tell you both of those guys have been very vocal about their dislike with the current setup of the PGA Tour schedule, where you have full field events and then signature events like we have here this week. Their argument is that, you know, first off, the money. If you combine the winning check of the last two events, talking about the American Express and the Farmers Insurance Open, it would not make up what the winner's going to get this week, which is $3.6 million. And the thing that they're arguing is that it's hard to get into the top 50 or make it to the BMW Championship because there are far more FedEx Cup points handed out in these signature events. And kind of once you get in, you know, it's harder to fall out. It's harder for these fulfillment players to get in. On the other side of the scope, the PGA Tour is saying, well, these events, these signature events are aspirational. So, you know, Lonto Griffin has been very vocal amongst the membership, and so has Grayson Murray in regards to what happened in formulating this schedule. As a matter of fact, he and Rory McIlroy kind of had a little back and forth at the RBC Canadian when the June 6th announcement was made in the player meeting that Jay Monahan was a part of. So, yeah, it's an eclectic group, but I am surprised to see a couple of names on there.
Todd, seven of the names on that list are returning guys who were on it last year. Nine are new, and of the new nine, eight of them would fairly be described as rank-and-file players. Does that suggest to you a deliberate effort to try to rope that strata of the membership into the conversation here? Because we are getting to the point where decisions are going to be made that are going to leave a lot of bruised feelings out there, particularly, as you point out, among the guys who think they're getting the short end of the stick here.
Yeah, I do think the PGA Tour is wanting to have more of those, as you described, rank and file players on there. They have heard complaints from the pack that their voices aren't being heard. As a matter of fact, one pack member, if you remember last year, one pack member said that there was a proposal about these signature events and these no-cut events like we're going to have here this week that was just brought up to the pack as a possibility. And then the very next week, it was voted on as an actuality. And they said, well, what are we wasting? Are we just wasting our time here? We want to agree as a pack, put together a proposal, then have it go to the board. So I think there is an effort on both ends from the pack and from the PGA Tour to have more influence and more impact from the pack moving forward.
Well, from the pack to sponsor exemptions, always a talking point week to week. Four of them this week, an interesting lineup, I would say. You have Maverick McNealy, for example. He went to Stanford, just fulfilled his major medical. You've got a major champ in Adam Scott and Webb Simpson. Peter Malnati was in the mix last year, T4 at Pebble. Your thoughts on the sponsor exemptions list?
Well, I talked to Steve John, who again, runs the Monterey Peninsula Foundation here. He's essentially the tournament director for the AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am, and he and the board are in charge of handing out those sponsor invitations. This is a signature event, and under the rules, you have to be a PGA Tour member to get a sponsor's invite. But if you look at those guys, first off, Maverick McNealy has played well here. He loves this tournament. He's a California guy, so you understand that sponsorship going out. And the other three, Steve was telling me, look, they've all supported this tournament. And talking about Adam Scott, Peter Malnati, who was in the mix of this tournament last year, and Webb Simpson, they have played this a number of years. But it is interesting, and it's not by coincidence that three of those four, and Simpson and Scott and Malnati, also serve on the PGA Tour Policy Board. So this week, every member of the PGA Tour Policy Board, from a player's perspective, is playing in the AT&T Pebble Beach, with the exception of one, and that is Tiger Woods. He's not in the field, but don't be surprised if he's teeing it up at his tournament, the Genesis at Riviera.
Yeah, a couple weeks from now. Tilo, we appreciate the reporting. I hope the sun comes out, and thanks for the time.
You got it, guys. Good talking to you.
All right. Your thoughts on the first big picture. Let's go with the list of 16 players. You called it about eight of them about rank and file. Is this a team of rival situation where you need those voices in the room and not just have the star power, but have some of those players that are looking out for the larger PGA Tour body?
You absolutely need them, the voices in the room. The question is, do they move beyond the room that they're meeting in? I would anticipate a fair amount of fireworks at the Players Advisory Council level over the course of the next year or two, as whatever the new structure is takes shape. Because these are the guys who are more at risk of being left behind. And whether or not their voices carry to the PGA Tour Policy Board is another matter, because that board is heavily skewed towards elite players. It's Tiger, it's Cantlay, it's Jordan Spieth, it's Adam Scott. Webb Simpson's not exactly a man of the people. He's a major champion, sure, a player's champion. Peter Malnati's really the only rank-and-file player among the six player directors on the policy board. And there's a division that is widening in this game, and you can see it among the petition that has circulated among rank and file players demanding more accountability from the leadership of the PGA Tour. Decisions are about to be made, and the reactions, I think, are going to be pretty raw. So it's going to be interesting to see how this meeting space plays out.
The division has always been wide, but maybe widening even more so now in this era of fractured golf, and the fact that we still have players leaving and the tour doing whatever it can to really kind of satisfy its stars. Stars saying we need to play more, and purses needing to be elevated because of what we've seen in the last couple of years, which is the advent of a rival tour, even if negotiations are ongoing.
But don't you think it's a lousy look when they have to be sensitive to the rank and file, thinking that the elite are feathering their nests at their expense, that three of the four sponsors' exemptions in a tournament of this scale with this kind of purse go to those guys? And you can make a case for all of those guys be there, as Todd just pointed out. But you could make a case for a Gary Woodland to be there as well, who won the Open Pebble Beach 5 years ago. There are a lot of guys who could probably make a case for themselves. And I think it's a little bit of tone-deaf activity here when it comes to the perception, even among the membership, that the guys at the very top of the tree are being well-fed and everyone else is waiting for the crumbs.
We're going to Phoenix next week. We'll be sitting at 16 and doing our annual thing. But I'm looking forward to getting on the ground. And we like to walk the golf course and go to the driving range and talk to the players and find out what they think. I want to know. We know what the stars think. I want to know what the rank and file.
Oh, I think they got plenty to say.
No doubt. Hopefully they'll tell us on the record, folks. We're back on Golf Today. Rumil working overtime lately, especially about this then young man, now 38 years of age, Anthony Kim, reported to be considering a comeback to professional golf, PGA Tour, LIV, unsure. But X on social media has been hot about the rumor. And another one reports the Englishman, Tyrrell Hatton, European Ryder Cup, are reported to be joining Jon Rahm's LIV golf outfit. No word on if he'll get a jacket or not. Eamon Lynch, let's start with the Anthony Kim chatter. I thought that Todd Leonard really put it really well when he said that this is a narrow sliver of golf fandom that is excited just about the potential of a return.
It's a narrow sliver, but it's a loud sliver because this cult of mythology has grown up around Anthony Kim in the 12 years in May since he played a competitive round of golf. And it's built up for two reasons. Firstly, is this sense, which most golf fans should have, that there was so much more to be accomplished in his career, that he was only 26 years old when he walked away. And this is a game where guys just keep going well into their 60s and 70s. So when they walk away at 26, it becomes noticeable. And the reason that mythology has continued to build up is Anthony Kim has never attempted to dispel it. And you look, you know, we're both tennis fans. Bjorn Borg walked away when he was 25 and then 10 years later decided to make a comeback. And it was atrocious. Yeah. He came back with a wooden racket and the results were lousy. And the idea that Anthony Kim could come back and compete against the guys who are out there now, to me, seems at best fanciful out there. What you're really looking at is ultimately a 38-year-old with three wins. He's Scott Stallings, except he's got a bit more moxie and shinier belt buckles. But the career is not of a standard where he's no Bjorn Borg in terms of stature or record. We're not talking about an absolute legend here based on his accomplishments. We are talking about someone who's legendary because he walked away.
The moments were loud, though. Let's not forget 2008 Ryder Cup Valhalla, oversized belt buckle, oversized American flag, knocking out Sergio Garcia. And if you're an American Ryder Cup golf fan and you watch someone beat Sergio Garcia 5-4, I mean, you're in the club.
But even the Europeans admired him for that.
That's a good point. But he also had other moments. 11 birdies, a record at the Masters in 2009.
Which he didn't win.
Which he did not win. But there was that smoke around him. He was young and hard-charging and a partier. Famously, it told me the story of, after one of his wins, walking up to Tiger on the driving range at 9:30 in the morning, and Tiger congratulating him on his win, and AK puffing out his chest and saying, hey, you want to go play a practice round? And Tiger's like, I've already played my practice round. I've been here since 6 o'clock in the morning. And AK at that time saying, you know, I better get my act together. But there definitely is a feeling around him of unfinished business. But the question is, could he even finish that business at this juncture of his life?
Yeah, it's a wonderful story to dream about, but it feels as though the moment has passed. He lived hard and fast. Hopefully he's in a better place now than he seemed to be when he left the game back in 2012. But the idea that a dozen years later that he could suddenly make an impact other than drawing a few curiosity watchers, and ultimately it would say an awful lot about LIV Golf if he did come back and play for LIV. I don't see him coming to the tour where you actually have to earn the money and earn the status to claw his way back. If he did come back on the tour, it tells you that the old confidence is intact, that he thinks he can do that. But ultimately, you know, LIV signs John Rahm. It tells you what they aspire to be. Signing Anthony Kim would tell you what they are, which is overly reliant on gimmickry to try to draw eyeballs.